Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we have a very special subject in store for you. I don't think we've ever discussed it before. It is infertility and preconceptual planning. Infertility is a big problem with our change in demographics. More and more people are waiting longer and longer before they have babies. And as a result, we're seeing a good deal of infertility. Maybe there are some other environmental reasons. We'll go into that later. Also, preconceptual planning, very important, because you want to have a healthy baby, and so much more goes into it than just an egg and a sperm. So today we're going to talk to an expert. She is Dr. Jacqueline Chassie. Dr. Chassie is a naturopathic doctor, an ND. She is an exceptionally well-trained naturopathic physician who is co-founder of Northeast Integrative Medicine, and that is located in New Hampshire. She also has extensive background in biochemistry, and she has done extensive research in the field of women's health, also focusing on infertility and preconceptual planning. She currently lectures all over the country. I've lectured with her. She also works as medical educator for Emerson Ecologics, which is a manufacturer, not so much a manufacturer, but a distributor of all manner of natural supplements to professionals in the field of natural medicine. So without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. Jacqueline Chassie. Jacqueline, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about this issue of infertility. Frame it for us. A big problem? Is it increasing in magnitude?
It is a big problem. So, you know, rates of infertility have really been skyrocketing over the years. The Center for Disease Control tracks rates of infertility, and in women, they've been increasing pretty substantially to the point where they've more than doubled in the last 20 years. The most recent statistic was measured about 10 years ago in 2002, showing that upwards of 15% of couples were having impaired fertility, which, just to put things in perspective for you, that's the same rate of frequency of breast cancer in this country. So, of course, we don't talk as much about infertility as we do about breast cancer, but it's a huge problem for couples today.
Wow. Okay. And it causes a great deal of consternation, psychological distress. There's a lot of suffering associated with that. Any particular reasons why this should be the case?
Well, you know, we're not really sure about what leads to difficulty conceiving, and the chances are that it's many factors. You know, some of the things that have been looked into include things like couples trying to get pregnant later in life, which certainly has an impact. However, we're seeing infertility rates climb in all age groups, even those under 20 years old. We think also that there's a lot to do with our environment. You know, we know that a lot of the chemicals that we expose ourselves to every day that are really can be impossible to avoid through food and air and water, and, you know, what we choose to put in our home, things like that. A lot of those chemicals have been pretty well studied in animals and in humans and shown to have negative impacts on fertility. One great example is BPA, which is one of the chemicals I think most people have heard of now in plastics and in the lining of aluminum cans and things like that. But they initially thought that there might be some fertility issues because they found that in runoff streams from factories that were producing BPA, fish were actually losing their reproductive organs and becoming hermaphrodites. So they started to say, well, gosh, if this is happening in fish, could it happen in humans? And they found that it does really impair fertility. It has a similar effect in the body to an old drug called DES, which is now not recommended because it can really harm growing babies and, you know, harm their fertility as well.
That's diethylstilbestrol, which actually was included in animal feed until, I guess it was recently, because it was thought to make a, you know, bigger, fattier, more valuable animal at the marketplace.
Yeah, well, we're not always correct about those things, are we?
Yes.
We don't understand the complexity of our biochemistry and how things are going to interact with us.
Indeed. Actually, they, from time to time, an article appears saying that the quality of men's sperm isn't what it once was, that rates of male infertility or the number and healthy characteristics, the movement characteristics or motility of sperm is declining in the Western world for one reason or another. And perhaps we have to look to the possibility of industrial pollution.
Yeah, I mean, personally, with all the research I've done, I think industrial pollution plays a really big role in our decline in fertility. They've also done studies citing nutritional changes, which I think plays a big role as well. But I think when you look at what's happened over the last 50 years in this country and the number of things we're exposed to, our exposures have increased exponentially, and I think it has to have an impact on our fertility as well as on the health of our children. And, you know, the rates of disease we're seeing in adults.
So typically you will see infertile couples at the Northeast Integrative Medicine Clinic. And what are some of the considerations for you as you look into how to overcome their impediments to having a successful pregnancy?
Yeah, well, I did a lot of my training in Australia where patients typically saw a naturopath first. And that was very interesting because, you know, we were really responsible for working them up for the infertility and figuring out what was wrong. In the U.S., I find that most patients that come in to see me have already been through the fertility workup through conventional medicine.
So what you're saying is in Australia, you actually, it was routine to have a multidisciplinary clinic there where they would have a medical workup, you know, with all the wondrous new drugs that they have and techniques, you know, IVF and IUI and you name it. But as a prelude to going through the high-tech thing, they would say, well, go see the naturopath.
Yeah, isn't that unique?
Yeah.
It sounds so foreign compared to what we have here. But
right.
Yeah, in Australia, same thing with birth. You know, the government health care covers you to see a midwife,
mm-hmm.
unless you have a complicated birth, in which case you are referred to an OB and it's covered. But if you want to see an OB and your birth is uncomplicated or not high risk, you have to pay out of pocket, which is backwards. In the U.S., you have to pay out of pocket for a midwife.
Of course, we know that Australia is a very, very backward country where people live in tents and wrestle with alligators or crocodiles, I guess it is, over there. And therefore, naturopaths are necessary. But here in a more advanced country, we tend to think of naturopaths as a provider of last resort. If all else fails, go see the naturopath. I'm being sarcastic.
And I don't necessarily mind that. We get the hardest cases. It's a lot of fun. We get to use our brains.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so when couples come in, oftentimes they have a diagnosis of why they haven't gotten pregnant. Either, you know, they'll say that there's something wrong with the men's sperm, and they'll have already had that evaluation. Women typically have already had hormone testing and ultrasounds to look at the kind of physical structure of their uterus and fallopian tubes. They've oftentimes had testing done to see what kind of quality their eggs are. Or many of them have even already gone through IVF, where you really look at a step-by-step process of conception, and you can see what step isn't working well. So it makes my job a lot easier in a way. We don't have to do that evaluation, but we do, you know, in my opinion, have to dig a little deeper to say, okay, well, your eggs aren't good quality, but you're only 34, so why? You know, why are you different than most women that are 34, whose egg quality should be still pretty well preserved? So then we have to start to dig a little deeper into those lifestyle factors like nutrition and the quality of the food they're eating, what their exposures are through their jobs maybe or through their hobbies. You know, I've worked with a lot of artists that get exposed to heavy metals, for example, and glazes and paint. Or in our area, we have a lot of farmers. So we'll see farmers whose sperm counts are drastically decreased in the summer, when they're typically handling pesticides and things like that. But then come fall, we'll start to see them rebound. So there are some really interesting trends you can observe when you kind of dig a little bit deeper looking into why a couple is having trouble conceiving.
Indeed. And so you might be looking at factors like mercury levels, lead, and so on that are ignored. But is there such a thing as, you know, some sort of miracle grow, a natural way of enhancing egg quality or sperm quality when it comes to vitamins, minerals, supplements?
There are quite a few things that have been studied to improve egg and sperm quality. A couple of nutrients that have a lot of research are NAC, which stands for N-acetylcysteine, which is a sulfur-rich antioxidant that also thins mucus. So it's used most commonly, I would say, for upper respiratory support, thin mucus, when people are congested. But it also has good research to improve both egg and sperm health. And I think also, you know, sometimes women's cervical mucus, which is really important for sperm to be able to swim, isn't the right consistency. And I think NAC probably helps with that, too.
Right.
Other nutrients include carnitine and acetyl-L-carnitine, which really have most of their research on brain health and kind of energy production. But they're also great for fertility. And a lot of other antioxidants have been looked at, too. So primarily, we see things like different antioxidants that are studied. Melatonin is another great example of a hormone that acts like an antioxidant that has good fertility research. We look at hormone balance. And we look at the inflammation levels and also fatty acid status, or how much of those good omega-3 fats we have in your body.
What about, we had some preliminary discussions the other day about DHEA. I sent you an email after I uncovered an article about DHEA, not the thing from fish oil, which is certainly beneficial in pregnancy, but DHEA, the hormone for enhancing fertility.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So DHEA has a good amount of research on specifically on supporting egg quality in women. One of the reasons why we think the quality of a woman's eggs declines as she ages is actually because her testosterone declines naturally with aging. And they've done research initially with women using testosterone replacement and found it's very successful at improving egg quality.
Wow, that's absolutely counterintuitive. You wouldn't think that. You think, well, that'd be the last thing you'd want to do. Otherwise, you know, could it interfere perhaps with pregnancy, make a more masculine baby or masculinize a female baby if the baby is born? It doesn't have that effect?
No, and they don't typically dose it during pregnancy. So once a woman is pregnant, she'll discontinue it.
Right.
But, yeah, I had the same thought process when I stumbled upon that research. But that was really the foundation of going towards DHEA, is just concern about really side effects. So a woman taking testosterone, getting her in the upper levels of a healthy range, some women will have side effects like abnormal hair growth or aggression,
acne.
And so they were looking, for alternatives for women that might be a little bit less intense. So that's how DHEA began to be studied. And they, in fact, find that when women take DHEA, they usually dose pretty high, 25 milligrams three times daily is the dose used in most studies. And to put things in perspective, if I'm giving it to someone for adrenal health, I usually only use 5 to 10 milligrams.
Exactly. Me too. Maybe in like a very, very resistant case, 25 milligrams, or perhaps in lupus where that may be helpful, go a little higher. But, you know, certainly that's a higher dose than we might ordinarily give. So these are interesting techniques for women. What about for men? I believe there's some studies that show that the sperm swim more actively. You know, it seems like that arduous kind of like trout spawning, you know, going up the stream to find their nesting ground. That's what sperm have to encounter. They have to be pretty energetic little cells.
Yeah. They take a lot of energy. So sperm, you know, are made, of course, in the testes. And there's a tissue in the testes called the epididymis. And this is where sperm mature. And the number of the cell organelle called mitochondria, which mitochondria are responsible for energy production. In the epididymis, there is the highest concentration of mitochondria of any cell type in the body. The second is the heart. but mitochondria are about 200 times more concentrated in the epididymis than they are in the heart. So when you look at how much energy that cell needs to make, you can imagine how important energy production is for sperm. Of course, because they whip that tail, they have to move quite a long distance considering how tiny they are. So there's a lot of great nutrients to support sperm health. The first one I like to start with is fish oil, because so many of us are omega-3 deficient anyway. But they actually looked, there was a study in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition a couple years ago that looked at men with the worst type of sperm possible. It's called, and I just love to say this word, oligoespinoteratophermia.
Wow.
Or OAT. So it means they had low count, bad morphology, which is the shape of the sperm, and poor motility, which means they didn't swim very well. And taking just a fish oil daily, 1,000 milligrams of EPA plus DHA, nearly doubled sperm count and concentration, and also had positive effects on motility and morphology. So that's a really simple intervention that I like to start with. But there's a lot of other nutrients as well, like CoQ10, which CoQ10 is a great antioxidant and also supports production of energy by the mitochondria, which is why we think it's so effective. CoQ10 is especially effective for improving sperm, how well they can swim, how fast they can swim. And then I talked a little bit about carnitine and acetyl L-carnitine before, but those also have a pretty significant impact on sperm motility. And it's usually dosed at about 3 grams per day total of acetyl plus regular carnitine.
Wow, that's really interesting that there's actually a cocktail of nutrients that can help. What about traditional Chinese medicine? I know that in acupuncture and traditional Chinese herbal medicine, they place a big premium on fertility because, I guess, in the old China, the new China used to have the one-child policy, but the old China, it was all about making sure that you have a male descendant and lots of kids to carry on the family name. So fertility became a big part of traditional Chinese medicine. Any hints from that realm?
Yeah, well, first, I didn't know about kind of the history of that, and that's why there's so much interest in kind of acupuncture and fertility. That's really interesting. So Chinese medicine and acupuncture are a therapeutic I love, and in our office, when I work with a couple, I oftentimes recommend acupuncture for a number of reasons. You know, one, it can help with hormone balance, you know, whether you're using Chinese herbs or just acupuncture treatments. And it also can address improving blood flow to the uterus, which is one of the ways we think it really helps women. There have been some good studies done in patients that are undergoing IVF where they do acupuncture surrounding the time of the embryo transfer, which is when the woman has already kind of given her eggs, they've been mixed with sperm, you know, outside of the body, and the embryo transfer is when they put that cluster of cells or that embryo back into the woman. So they have looked at that and found that acupuncture actually does increase implantation rates, which means it increases pregnancy rates in couples that are undergoing IVF. So we think it does that by really helping to, one, calm down inflammation, and two, improve blood flow in the uterus, which, of course, then allows you to get rid of waste and bring in nutrients. So it can be really helpful. I think another big benefit of acupuncture in Chinese medicine is the stress relief aspect of acupuncture. And, of course, when you're trying to conceive, it can become a really stressful process, and stress impedes fertility. So anything you can do to help to manage that stress is welcomed. And I think acupuncture is one of those things that's highest on my list for that.
Well, it is of interest that in American clinics, while often they don't have naturopaths advising people to take supplements and change their diets, they often have psychological counseling or people who specialize in biofeedback and relaxation. There is an emerging trend in the infertility field to recognize that stress is something that needs to be coped with. And is that something that you address in your clinic in New Hampshire?
Absolutely. So, I mean, of course, stress can be protective or it can be damaging, right? But when we have too much stress, it definitely affects fertility. And we used to think it was all related to the hormone cortisol, one of our stress hormones. But we actually know that stress inhibits directly the communication between the brain and the reproductive organs, even without cortisol's involvement. So, you know, stress really has or can have a negative impact on fertility. And they've done a lot of studies looking at different types of treatments for that, different types of counseling, like they've looked at studies on yoga. They've looked into a counseling technique they call letting go counseling, which I'm sure you've probably heard stories, most of the listeners have, about couples who were trying to get pregnant and really struggling, and then eventually they decide to adopt. And as soon as they make that decision and they're in the adoption process, well, bam, they fall pregnant, right? And letting go counseling kind of follows that model where you're really trying to let go of the outcome and kind of release a little bit of control. They've looked at group therapies and a lot of other psychotherapy interventions and found them to be, for the most part, helpful. So I think, you know, rather than give a specific stress management treatment for fertility, I really base it more upon what that couple kind of would enjoy the most, you know, whether it's something like yoga or more traditional therapies.
And I have to say that when enumerating your credentials, Jacqueline, I also didn't mention the fact that you were the mother of its two children now, right? Correct?
Yeah, two little boys. That's right.
So you've been there, done that. You're not just speaking from a theoretical standpoint.
No, it's absolutely, you know, it's important to take good care of yourself when you're trying to get pregnant. And I've been really blessed that I haven't struggled with fertility with my own children. But, you know, when I had my second child, it took a few months to get pregnant. And, you know, I completely understand that desire of when you're ready to have a baby, you're ready to have a baby yesterday. So having to wait is challenging. And, I've experienced that stress firsthand.
Well, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about preconceptual planning, because, you know, we often talk about childhood nutrition. We talk about, you know, what should you give to your baby to make your baby smart, to make your baby grow healthy. But actually, the important, a very, very important phase of this begins in utero, and actually it may begin even preconceptually, you know, before you undertake conceiving a child. So talk to us about some of the nutritional considerations around pregnancy.
Absolutely. So, you know, it takes 4 months for egg and sperm to mature. So when a man gives a sperm sample, he's actually been making those sperm for a little over 100 days. So you can imagine, you know, if those sperm were made in an environment filled with alcohol and a poor diet, that their health might be a little bit different.
So you're saying wait at least 4 months after the bachelor party in Las Vegas, kind of have a nice 4 month height.
Absolutely.
Okay, because you need to wash that out of your system. Right.
That's right. Give a little washout time.
Right.
But you know, in an ideal world, you would have 4 months before you conceived, where you're really focused on living a very clean lifestyle and eating really healthy diet and clean water and things like that. So, you know, I like to talk about that with my patients and give them some really good lifestyle recommendations. Some of the things that have the greatest fertility support, in addition to being really helpful just to make healthy egg and sperm and therefore a healthy baby, you know, the diet that I typically recommend to patients is what I would call a modified Mediterranean diet. So Mediterranean diet is used in cardiovascular disease quite a lot. It's a diet pattern that's rich in fruits and vegetables, kind of lower on the intake of animal products, low amounts of saturated fat, but really high amounts of kind of fish and shellfish and a lot of, you know, animal products that supply omega-3 fats. Also lots of olive oil, as much as 20 milliliters per day, which is two-thirds of an ounce. So that's quite a bit. That's, let's see, about 4 tablespoons per day. And you know, lots of beans and legumes and things like that, in a lower carbohydrate diet. And they've done studies looking at women in the Netherlands and in Spain, and what we see is that couples who adhere to a Mediterranean diet have much higher fertility and pregnancy rates than couples who do not. And they've also compared it to a standard American diet and found it to be far superior. And additionally, when they look at nutrient levels in the blood on the Mediterranean diet, there's much higher levels naturally of folic acid and vitamin B6, both in the blood as well as within the follicles themselves, within the eggs themselves. So there's actually more nutrients in that fluid that can be really helpful to kind of get an embryo started. So that's one thing that is really important. And then there are, of course, really specific nutrients that are key. You know, I always recommend starting with a very good quality prenatal vitamin. And really the key nutrients in the prenatal vitamin would be iron, calcium, folate, and zinc. But they've looked at studies where they give just those nutrients versus a whole multivitamin, and multivitamins seem to perform better and they get present more easily. So,
and they can't quite pin down what it is among the multitude of nutrients in a multi that gives some added benefit.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. But I think, you know, it does emphasize the need for that whole nutrient, really just to bridge the gap. Even when we are people who eat mostly well, we all have days that you can't, or, you know, there might be patterns to how we eat where we're deficient in one nutrient or another. So I think it's good to cover your bases.
So,
and then the other thing is fish oil, which I talked about for men, but that would be really important for women as well.
Right, and there are actually studies that suggest that consumption of fish oil, particularly the EPA, I'm sorry, the DHA part of the fish oil is essential for optimal brain development. And in effect, you can have a baby with increased IQ points if you take adequate omega-3s.
That's right. So if you live in Manhattan and want your kid in the best preschool, that's another reason to get started on that before you
try to compete. Right, because the interviews are coming up really quick. You know, maybe they're already coaching kids in play skills. It's pretty ridiculous here, but some of the parents or grandparents who are listening to this, they know that they actually have special courses like, remember those Kaplan courses that we took to get into college or, you know, get an SAT score or get into med school or whatever, advanced graduate school? Well, they're doing special courses for little kids in Manhattan so they can get into the right preschool so that they show up on the original play interview, and they play, nicely so that they get that cherished berth in an Ivy League bound play environment.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. It's a lot of pressure.
Learning how to fear blocks and,
yes.
Yeah.
So the fish oil does play a role in pregnancy, and in a couple of ways, I understand. One is that it seems to help to prevent miscarriages. How does it do that?
Well, fish oil, especially the EPA component, is a really potent anti-inflammatory. And within the uterus, if there's inflammation, it prevents the embryo from really kind of making that lock and key with the wall of the uterus, and it can really prevent implantation from happening optimally. And so fish oil actually helps to lower the levels of inflammation within the uterus, which allow implantation to happen better, and that can lower the rate of miscarriage.
Which, and if not miscarriage, I mean, certainly premature delivery and immaturity is a major cause of problems. And we can now, you know, babies who are 28 weeks or 32 weeks, they sometimes can survive, but it's there's a big toll that it takes on the child's health.
You're right. Yeah, they've looked at, you know, fish oil and a multivitamin, a prenatal multivitamin, have both been shown, not only just to help you conceive, but to help you have a healthier pregnancy and a healthier baby. So lower risk of low birth weight, which is another thing that can put your child kind of at risk for being a preemie, or decreased rates of stillborn and decreased rates of neonatal death or death of very young children. And then the other piece of that is that the moms who have taken these nutrients tend to have better micronutrient status themselves after birth, which can mean potentially lower rates of postpartum depression and an easier time breastfeeding, you know, more nutrients to put into breast milk if the mom wants to breastfeed.
What about some common problems of pregnancy? One is nausea pregnancy. What are some of the things that can be taken for that?
I'm working with a patient with this right now who's been just so, so sick in her first trimester. So nausea in pregnancy usually starts, you know, about 6 weeks and can last until about 12 weeks pregnancy. And there are a couple of natural solutions that can be really helpful. The first is ginger, which you can use ginger in any form you want. You could suck on, you know, fresh root, You could juice it. You could have a ginger candy. There's a lot of different ways to dose that. You can take it in a capsule, too. So if you don't like the taste of it, a ginger capsule can be really helpful still. And another nutrient that has some good research is vitamin B6. So vitamin B6, you have to dose a little bit higher in the milligram dosing, but that can also be helpful to calm down nausea. In fact, when I have women that are really so nauseous they can't even take a capsule, I'll sometimes give them a B vitamin injection with a little extra B6 in it, just to help to calm that nausea down.
So that certainly can be helpful, especially in the first trimester when that problem arises. What about preeclampsia? That got a prominent media placement in an episode of Downton Abbey last year when I guess it was, what was her name? Was it Sylvia? One of the major characters died in agony after giving birth to a child, and it illustrated the hazards of preeclampsia, which used to be a fatal disease even in the 20th century before they recognized that it could be treated. There's some natural approaches that help to forestall that.
So they think that nutrient status plays a role in the development of preeclampsia, along with exposure to environmental toxins. A few toxins have been implicated too. So I would say eat organic. Again, take a prenatal. And if you're prone to preeclampsia, I would recommend doing an extra magnesium. So when you're pregnant, it's a great idea to take a calcium with magnesium so you have some extra minerals for the baby to utilize as they're growing their bones. And if you have a history or risk of preeclampsia, instead of taking twice as much calcium as magnesium, which most products have in it, I would take a product that has equal amounts of calcium and magnesium. So you want about 500 milligrams of each. And that can really help to keep your blood vessels flexible and keep the smooth muscles around your blood vessels from clamping down, which can cause an increase in blood pressure. I haven't seen the Downton Abbey episode. It's on my Netflix queue, but I'll keep my eyes open for it.
Yeah, absolutely, because that's, I think, is, you know, because when I saw that episode, I was literally screaming at the TV. I was saying, give her some magnesium! Give her some magnesium! And they all stood around helplessly while she, you know, continued to have seizures and died. Of course, in a modern setting, you would also give powerful medications to suppress the seizures. But part of the even to this day, the treatment for preeclampsia is to give not just oral magnesium, but as you know, intravenous magnesium, which is kind of cool.
That's right. Yeah, and it's a pretty effective therapy.
Absolutely. A problem that occurs with women sometimes in pregnancy or post-pregnancy at a time when sometimes women want a nurse and they may not want to take medication. I know it's controversial. There's some studies that say, oh, no problem, you can take antidepressants during pregnancy. But I'm sure a lot of women are skeptical of that claim and they don't want to be taking things. Are there natural supplements or herbs that can be used to gently alleviate the pregnancy blues or postpartum depression that show promise?
Yeah, I've had a few things that can be really helpful for women in postpartum depression. And, you know, what I would emphasize, if any of the listeners are dealing with that, is that it is really important to find some kind of solution. You know, whether it's natural medicine or whether it's counseling or a medication, it's really important to overcome that so that you can take care of yourself and take care of your baby.
Right.
I've worked with some women who've had a really difficult time, and you know, at that point, you want to use any help that is available to you that's going to work. But there are some natural things that I love to start with. So a couple things that I'll utilize in women are like lemon balm and catnip, which are really gentle herbs that have some safety studies in kids. So I think, you know, if you were taking that orally and it was coming through your breast milk a little bit, in that small of an amount, it would probably be fine for a young baby. I also recommend doing high-dose fish oil. Because there has been research that it's not a not causative research, but it looks at women with postpartum depression, and typically women who experience some of the baby blues tend to have lower levels of omega-3 in their blood than women who don't. So we're not sure whether it's causative or not, but I think it certainly wouldn't help. I mean, wouldn't hurt to get that into your bloodstream in a little bit higher level. I also work with women on hormone balance because things like thyroid health should be
checked. Yes, thyroid, I think, is a very important often missed diagnosis in postpartum pregnancy, because clearly there's some women who may show relatively borderline thyroid status, but they really respond well, as you know, to natural thyroid.
They do, yeah. And, you know, especially around that 2 month mark, and again around that 4 month mark, women's hormones really shift at those time points after pregnancy. And if I see changes occur in that time frame, I'm always suspicious of the thyroid, because the thyroid can sometimes become a little bit sluggish around that time. And then the other thing is adrenal health, looking at adrenal glands, which are stress managing glands. And, you know, when you're pregnant, your body is pumped through with its own natural endorphins and anti-inflammatories and all the stuff that leaves you feeling really good and making your hair grow so fast and glossy. And then those hormones go away, and it can be kind of a crash, right? And the adrenals are really important to make sure that your body can handle that change, you know, that stress of having the baby outside of your body rather than in. So I like herbs like ashwagandha, which has been used in India for quite a long time. It's usually taken as a powder. It's a ground up root powder, and you can mix it into a little bit of warm milk and add honey and cinnamon and kind of make it into like a chai and drink that in the evening. And that's really one of my favorite remedies for new moms. It's also great to help with milk supply.
Oh, interesting. There is the notion in conventional OBGYN that you need lots and lots of iron, or that you need lots and lots of calcium in a pregnancy. Is this always true, or are we going overboard with supplementation?
Well, you know, humans have been having babies for a lot longer than supplements have been around, right? And I think we wouldn't be here if we absolutely needed supplements to survive a pregnancy. Just like we wouldn't be here if we needed hospitalization to survive a pregnancy, right? So I think that those nutrients are really important, because with iron, for example, when you're pregnant, you increase your blood volume. The mom increases her blood volume by about 30%. And that's a lot of red blood cells to make. So if you don't have enough iron, it's easy to become anemic. But I would only recommend iron if a woman is anemic. Otherwise, she should be getting it through her diet. One of the big reasons for that is supplementing iron can commonly lead to constipation.
Which is bad enough in pregnancy, right?
Yeah, it's a challenging complaint for a lot of women during pregnancy anyway. So you don't want to make that worse.
Right.
And with calcium, same thing. You can get it through your food. That's better, but you should be shooting for about 1,200 milligrams per day of calcium, whether that's through food or whether you need to take a little bit of a supplement to meet that requirement.
And what about the ideal amount of weight that is permissible to gain? You know, they used to say to women, you know, you got to gain, 30, 40 pounds with pregnancy. Then they had a shift in attitude, and they said, oh, you know, you got to watch your weight during pregnancy, and then women would feel guilty if they gained more weight. And they were actually putting women on sort of a restrictive kind of program. That might not have been good either. So what's a happy medium?
Well, most healthy women will gain between 20 and 40 pounds with a single pregnancy, not twins, which of course they gain a little more. I don't really focus too much on weight, women with weight in pregnancy. I really want to make sure they feel good, and I just remind them that, you know, that concept of eating for two is not correct. You know, when you are pregnant, you need about 200 extra calories per day, which that's not much. You know, you don't need too much. That's like an extra couple apples.
You don't want to put the feed bag on, in other words.
Exactly. So as long as you're not hitting the bonbons and the ice cream on a regular basis, you know, I wouldn't track your weight too much. I would just really pay more attention to sticking with a whole foods diet.
And there is now controversy over the role that alcohol might play, because, for a while they were permissive about, again, this is one of these pendulum swing kinds of things. For a while they were permissive about a little bit of alcohol during pregnancy. Everybody knows that too much alcohol is bad, but, you know, occasional beer or wine, they would say, no big deal. Now they literally have warnings in bars. They're concerned about fetal alcohol syndrome, zero tolerance for alcohol. And yet, a recent study, and I think you probably follow this kind of stuff because this is your field, showed that a little bit of alcohol consumption, you know, maybe a couple of drinks, a low alcohol beverage here and there, doesn't have a negative outcome on pregnancy. What's your take on that?
So when it comes to getting pregnant, I think alcohol has a really big impact, enough that I recommend couples avoid it if they can. You know, if you have alcohol in your medicine or something like that in the tincture, I think that's fine. But I wouldn't make even drinking small amounts of alcohol a regularity when you're trying to conceive. It really does. It's one of the only things we've really proven that affect egg and sperm quality. So I recommend people really avoid it when they're trying to get pregnant. And I also think that during early pregnancy, it's a really risky time. So, you know, can you have a sip of wine with dinner or half a glass of wine? Yeah, I think you can do that once in a while. But I would keep it to a minimum. Once you hit about 12 or 13 weeks, and you're moving into your second trimester, alcohol appears to be a little bit safer. And at that point, I don't, you know, really push the no alcohol thing with couples. Of course, you really don't ever want to drink to get drunk when you're pregnant. Not a great idea to get your blood alcohol level that high. But I think if you want to enjoy a little bit of a drink along with your meal once in a while, that there's not enough data out there to say that that's really harmful. So I don't typically tell women that they have to avoid it at that point. Plus, you add the stress relief benefit of, you know, just the relaxation ritual of enjoying a glass of wine with dinner or something like that. And I think there's a little bit of benefit to that there.
And now, of course, there's studies that say... Yeah, go ahead.
I think what I was going to add is I think there's a lot we just don't know. So I think you use common sense and stick to what we call the precautionary principle, where if it sounds like a bad idea, don't do it, right? But I think in this case, you know, we can probably lighten up our restrictions on women in their pregnancy with alcohol intake.
You know, clearly there has to be a happy medium, because we don't want women to succumb to orthorexia, which is an over... concerned with each morsel of food they consume. But clearly there is an impact of diet on the outcome. And it's studies now show that women who consume junk diets during pregnancy, their kids have a predisposition to crave junk food and become obese and diabetic.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? You know, we're learning more and more about what we call epigenetics, which is how we think things like that happen, which you know, you're born with your genome, your genes that come from your mom and dad, your DNA. But there's all these ways that DNA has like little caps on it, or the way it's twisted and coiled, that impacts the way that genes can be read. We call that epigenetics. So I think of it like if your genes are a book, you know, with all the string of letters, your epigenetics is like your table of contents that tells you where to turn and whether there's pages stuck together that you can't open and things like that. But things that we've looked at epigenetic studies for the time before pregnancy, that 4 months before, as well as during pregnancy, and we know that it actually changes the way genes are read in the offspring, and that it's heritable, meaning that if you know when you're pregnant, if you have a activity that affects your baby, it can affect multiple generations, and the imprinting that happens to the genes can stick around for up to, in animal studies, up to 7 generations.
Wow.
So it really can be very impactful time.
Wow, that is, really emphasizes the importance of the work that you do. So you're up at the Northeast Integrative Medicine Center, and do you accept patients from out of state? Because you're up there in New Hampshire in the Northeast, but do people from all over the country consult with you?
They do. Yep, I see patients from all over the country, and thanks to the technology of things like Skype, it can be almost like a face-to-face visit.
Okay, so we have a website. It's Northeast Integrative, one word, northeastintegrative.com, and people can also go to your website. What will they find there? Additional resources and information?
Yeah, there's more information about the practice and about myself, as well as links to things like our blogs, where you can connect and get more kind of useful information, medical and health information.
Great. And I'll give out a number, if you don't mind. It's
sure.
The
phone number is?
Yeah, it's 603-647-0600. 603-647-0600. Jacqueline, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jacqueline Chassie, for your innovative work in this field, because you're really bringing a lot of science and medical knowledge to a vital area that's underserved in medicine.
Well, thanks. I love to serve this population and hope we can have lots of cute, healthy babies as a result.
Yes, indeed. All the best to you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or, alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.